to the House of Wisdom podcast, where we interview academics about their research and how it can change the world. I am Deepak Mawar, an academic.
And I'm Carlos, also an academic.
Welcome back. It's been a while.
Thanks.
It's been a long minute, but yeah. A few things happened in the time in which we last recorded an episode. Carl, but maybe you want to.
Yeah,
actually, no. Both of us. Yeah, actually.
Both of us. How dare you?
Both of us.
Start.
I got you. Yeah, I had a third wedding. Well, second wedding. Third wedding.
Yeah. Three. You're married to three people. That's what you mean.
No, to the same person three times. Just because I'm not committed enough. If it's just one wedding.
No.
My tip, if you ever think about doing multiple weddings, stop at the second one. No, actually, no, because I don't know. I have such PTSD from the last wedding. It was a wonderful event, but it almost destroyed me in terms of the organizing and experience of it all. It was wonderful, but I did not get to eat my caterpillar cake, is the conclusion. For those that don't live in the UK and you're thinking, what the hell is caterpillar cake? Basically, it is a chocolate cake shaped like a caterpillar. And yes, I am 8 years old, and that was my wedding wish, to have a cake shaped like a caterpillar. And that was the worst part of it was I had a plate, had a fork, was about to just tuck in, and then the catering guy was like, "We need you." I was like, "Oh, okay." And I put it on the side.
I mean, they're doing the catering.
I can't remember. I don't know what it was. They called me over for something. And I was like, "Okay, I'll leave this here in the kitchen. I'll come back for it." Came back and it was gone.
Oh no.
And the caterpillar cake was gone too, so it was all finished. So I didn't get to eat any of my cake.
Have you had one since?
A caterpillar cake?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's not the same.
It's not the same, as the wedding caterpillar cake. What was
it was
the
huge. It was
like?
it was a 40 piece one. So it was a massive
one. Wow. Wait, it was, you were commissioned.
No, Marks and Spencer's. I'm also like divulging into all the secrets of like how to keep a wedding cost effective. So wedding cake from a nice wedding shop? No.
Don't do that, because let's be honest, like when you're in your third wedding, surely you're gonna start thinking about costs at some point, right?
I've talked to quite a few friends that have done very similar things. They're like, it's a cake. You don't, because for guys and ladies that are going to get married soon, like wedding cakes are absurdly expensive. They can go up to like 500-600 euros or pounds. It's bad. And all it is because it's a wedding cake. You can go to your Albert Heijn in the Netherlands, or you can go to Marks and Spencer's in the UK, and you get a cake for about 80, 90 pounds. And you can get three or four of them, stack them up, make it look nice, and you sort it.
Wow, clever. But wait a minute. And also, yeah, wedding cake is just icing mostly, isn't it?
So yeah, we had a chocolate one. We had a chocolate one and vanilla one, but don't ask me how it tastes. So I'm sure it tastes good.
I'm sure you would have heard if it didn't taste good.
People yeah, exactly. I mean, the other part was, didn't get to eat my mains when I wanted to. So
You're just starving.
I think someone called us over. So my mom was like, "Oh, you need to talk to these family members." So then me and Deanna had to go over and talk to family members. And then by the time we got back, all the mains were gone. It was like, hold up, this is my wedding. The only thing I was really hyped about was the food, and I don't even get to eat it. And I got to eat that later on.
What was it?
Like reheated. Oh, Indian food. And I was really hyped for it. Oh, okay. We had a chicken tikka masala. We had a lamb kurai. We had some dal, which was nice. A lentil curry, which was super. It was great. I can't remember. We had loads of things. I was so hyped for it, and then I didn't get to eat it. Well, I mean, I got to eat it later on, but it was reheated. So it's kind of like,
not the same.
It's not the same, right? It's not the same. So that was sad. But had a good dance on the floor, on the dance floor, rather.
Yeah.
So that was fine. That was nice. So yeah, got married, never doing that again. I would recommend three weddings to the same person, because you'd never want to get divorced after that much. You're tired.
We've gone too far.
It's like you're having marital problems. It's not just show a few photos of the wedding. You go, no, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. I didn't go through all of that for us to get divorced. So yeah, on that basis, you know, it might make your marriage strong if you have multiple weddings. Maybe not your wallet. For sure, but your marriage will be strong, which is more important.
Yeah, that is the most important thing. So well done. I'm very happy that you've got a very strong marriage based on these three weddings.
But you also had some very, very, very awesome bit of news, right?
So I'm not married, but we welcomed our second daughter. So I have another little one, which means you're going to hear more about him. Unfortunately for you, Deepak. So that's that. We are very fortunate to welcome our second little one in September. And yeah, and so we've been very busy with this for the past couple of months, just trying to figure out life. How to navigate these new schedules and do so without sleep. Although, to be honest, no, I can't complain. It's super lovely. She plays with her bigger sister already. They're all smiling at each other and it looks like they're really scheming. So I don't know what we're in for, but it doesn't look good. It doesn't look
I want to tell the viewers that Carl's kids are just the cutest. So they are great. They're great fun. And I saw them recently and had a great time with the two of them. It was fantastic. So they're lovely, and they're both great parents. You and your partner doing an amazing job, and absolute troopers. Like, honestly, like the way you guys are powering through, like working on your research, teaching, and taking care of your two kids is unbelievable.
I tell you, you really learn how to be really good in time management when you have kids. All of a sudden you're like, look, I've got 4 hours. I will do everything I need to do really quickly before the nap ends. But cheers, man. And it's been a lot, and hence why it took us so long to get together again. We've been in contact, but we haven't been in podcast contact. Just how are you doing contact? You alive? Yes. Okay.
Yeah, and also, I mean, we kind of want to have a bit of a reset button, because I think last season was a season of like trying things out, figuring things out, and figuring out what we like, what we don't like, what we want to do. And so we wanted to take our time to actually get back and doing it properly, because I think we both agree, especially with so much political upheaval right now, that you need an academic voice in the discourse. And we just want to do it properly and not, let's say, test out things and then be like, it doesn't work. We wanted to really take our time. So that's why we had a bit of a break, but we do want to be committed, because we realize the importance of this podcast. And talking about importance, we should get into our topic for this episode. Carl, help us out. What are we looking at in this episode?
In this episode, we're very lucky to be joined by Olga Burliuk and Ladan Rabari, both from the University of Amsterdam, who are going to talk to us about their new book, Migrant Academics, Narratives of Precarity and Resilience in Europe. And this is a volume which, and I'll read directly from the website here, consists of narratives of migrant academics from the global south within academia in the global north. It is essentially a book of extremely well-written stories. They retell narratives from an autobiographic and autoethnographic perspective in a way that, I don't think I've been captured by a book more than I have this one in a very long time. You start reading one of these chapters, you probably won't stop until you finish it. And then I've been recommending it to everybody. And, put it this way, the success can already be seen. It's open access as well, which is great, because it means everyone can access it freely online, and we will provide the link for this episode too. It's got well over 10,000 downloads already, this book, which really speaks to the reach it's had in the time that it's been out. Probably fair to say that we actually recorded this interview in May, and that's actually really important to say that, because we wanted to release this a while back, but then life happened, and we didn't really want to do a half job with this. We wanted to release it at a good time. We were very excited to discuss this book with Olga and Ladan, and we hope you will enjoy this conversation.
So my first question is to do with the general public and why they should care about this research. So as a book, this is written by academics. This is perhaps written for academics, and the kind of experiences that academics, or especially migrant academics, will have within the halls of a university, or halls within a department of any institution. So my first question would be, why should the general public care about this research and this book?
I think the general public already cares about the topic that we research, so migration and precarity. Migration is one of those topics that is very influential in elections, precisely because people are so interested in it. And a lot of politicians use discourses around migration to convince their voters and their constituents. So I do believe that the interest is already there. But the question of what we offer to the public is one that I want to address. I think the first key thing that this book does is to offer insights into the academic world and to break down the ivory tower. To show the public, and of course, not everyone believes this, but there is an image of academia as a woke space that is disconnected from the realities of the world. And this book gives the readers insights into, you know, actual human and life experiences of academics trying to make it, find a partner, make a family, find a community, a place in the world, make a career, fight with microaggressions and survive a bad boss and so on. So yes, they are highly educated individuals, but they are also migrants with experiences of precarity in so many ways. And as an extension of this, what I think our book offers is relatability, that the general public can relate to academics more and can relate to migrants more. We help build a far more diverse image of both migrants and academics. And the fact that these stories include resilience and pain, but also good humor, will also hopefully help with the relatability. The third thing I think the public can gain from reading our book is insights into academic discussions on big topics such as injustice, intersectionality, and decolonization, but in a very accessible language and through stories. Our book also offers access to diverse stories from many geographical locations and people with, you know, different backgrounds. We have stories from different countries that the public may not necessarily know much about. And one can only hope that reading about all these different stories can also foster a sense of connection and solidarity with people around the world. And the last thing is, and I don't want to go so far to claim that we will have an impact on policy decisions, but I do believe that by changing views on migrants, we can at least hope that we will have an impact on the way that people think about politics and their elected officials.
So tell us about some of the challenges that migrant academics face in the global north.
Yeah, as the title says, it's a migrant academics narratives of precarity and resilience, which is what we added to the title as we went on. And we realized that these are stories of resilience as much as they are stories of precarity. And because we worked with such an open assignment and open understanding, broader understanding of precarity, we got very diverse stories. And now, you know, looking at it as a collective output, of course, we see, and you will see when you read the book, that, you know, the challenges are numerous in various aspects of professional life, but also personal life and social life. And often, you know, always that cannot be disintegrated. You're always living all of these simultaneously, right? And of course, you can see that there is a lot of diversity and variation based on one's citizenship and passport as the first step, but also race, gender, class, physical and mental ability, family status, family background, language skills, religion, combination of home and host countries, and existence or non-existence of knowledge and stereotypes of each other, right? So sometimes you carry on, you're almost better off in a country where there's nothing in common with your own than in a country where there is, right? So there's a lot of diversity. And the essays, like I said, we didn't sample, but our authors come from different countries, are based in different countries, are of different genders, sexualities, races, and backgrounds. And of course, you see that a lot came out. And that made it challenging for us to organize a table of contents, because none of the essays is singular or tackles just one. Okay, some essays are more focused than others, like around a specific issue. Any of the essays could have found itself in multiple sections, right? So in the end, we organized it around six parts. We have a part on belonging and non-belonging, a part on invisible inclusions and exclusions, and, you know, the different microaggressions there. We have a section on borders, mobility, and academic nomadism, and how that's extremely difficult, but at the same time, almost expected of you to keep moving. the complexities of privilege and precarity, the different, you know, notions of whiteness and non-whiteness, gendered precarity and sexualization, and specifically the aspect, you know, of gendered stories, and also embodied differences. what it is to be a person of color in Academia Global North, right? So you could read the book following our structure. You can read the essays in random order. You can read the essays in alphabetical order. You can read it by the author, by the first name, first word of the title, last letter of the title, yeah. And you will get a slightly different book. Because I think the sequence in which you read, you know, something in an essay will resonate with you most, and you will take that as you go on to read the next one, and you might see that more than something else, right? So I think we, of course, edited chapters in random order as they were coming in, and the structure was, you know, imposed after the fact almost, but you will read it with our structure. And I would almost suggest, you know, read it twice. It's like Julio Cortázar, you know, the hopscotch, where he has, you can read it in this order, or these are the numbers, follow the numbers, and, you know, you will get a different aftertaste. Yeah. So I think that's the case with us. But of course, now looking back at what is in there, there are so many things that are not in there and that we really hope to almost, you know, solicit contributions on as we work on the next book. You know, some issues that are mentioned, but maybe not to the full extent or not even at all picked up. For example, one thing I have to think is religion and, you know, the role of that, access to that when you're a migrant academic, the stigma of that when you're a migrant academic. Because I don't know if you've noticed, but academia is a very atheistic, anti-theistic, I don't know how best to call it, Western academia. It's like you're considered a little crazy if you're religious, even if you're Christian. I remember a fellow Ukrainian colleague was defending his PhD, and he's a very devout Christian, and he thanked God in his final speech for supporting him through the process, and there was like awkward chuckle in the room, right? But then, of course, you can imagine being a Muslim academic, being a woman in a headscarf. I have so many examples of my colleagues who would need to do daily prayer, and there was no designated space, and they would go to the fire, to the stairs, you know, the stairs, and then somebody from administration found out and said, sorry, this is fire hazard, you cannot pray in the stairs, you're blocking the stairs. It's like, nobody even knows where the stairs are. Like, I was the first to find the stairs. Like, what do you mean it's a fire hazard, right? So religion, there's so much to be said about that in relation to culture and in relation to academia, but also physical and mental health, right? Physical disability. We do have a chapter on mental health struggles, but there's so much more that can be said about that, and physical ability disability, or the damage to your health from, you know, absorbing all these microaggressions over a protracted period of time, but also neglect for your health because you don't have access to health insurance or health to healthcare, or you cannot articulate to the doctor or whatever. Separately linked to that, but also separately, parenthood, motherhood, unemployment, financial precarity. I wrote on my notes, financial ruin. I can imagine at some point you have neither built a capital in your home country nor in your host country. You know, you've been working full time forever, mostly unpaid.
We've talked about this, right? As well. Did we talk about our pensions before?
Yeah. Oh my God, pensions?
Do we know where we're at this point? Yeah.
No, because even if you built up any, right? It's like too little, and you'll get 5 euros from 10 countries. It's almost like getting royalties on academic publications.
My partner, I always talk about my kids, so this is not a surprise maybe to the listener of this podcast. But, you know, my partner and I were talking about the differences in our approach to healthcare. So talking about healthcare, just to get used to that and all the stress.
The different culture of the healthcare system, but then also just the financial access, legal access, knowledge of where even to turn to because it's organized so differently, right? And the damage that does over time. Again, for example, one of the stories that's not in the book is by a scholar we approached, you know, would you write about your experience? And she said, I would, but that would force me to then tell the story of my reproductive situation gone wrong because of no access to healthcare and because of pushing it too far in. And I'm not prepared to tell that story, so I will not be on your pages, right? So religion, health, motherhood, alienation from your home, actually, because we talk about, you know, longing for home and difficulty in your host country. But what about, you know, when the tables are reversed and you don't no longer feel, maybe not yet that you fit in here, but you no longer fit back home either. Language, something we mentioned already, you know, thinking, working, speaking, writing in a foreign language and what that does to you as a professional, but also as a person. The hierarchies of languages, the hierarchies of accents. And of course, then, you know, the the hierarchies within the groups of migrant academics themselves, right? And how these are maybe then reinforced by the institutions. So lots and lots to work on still, and lots and lots of just kind of the obvious to be mentioned, right? I'm just saying the obvious themes, but, you know, as you dig in, so much more will come up and surprise us.
So reading the book, one biggest takeaway that I took away from the chapters and reading the excerpts of migrant academics in the global north was the level of hypocrisy within academia, especially Ladan in your chapter. I thought it was really poignant when we look at the what I would call the villainous professor talking about sisterhood and the importance of it, and then the treatment that you experienced in the conferences and in your interactions with her. It almost felt like her research is this distant concept, this kind of plaything that she's messing around with, exploring in her own comfort and in her own time, and not necessarily practicing it in her own life and in her interactions with others within academia. And so I get this feeling of this kind of idea of research being in a bubble and not perhaps being exercised and applied. And I want to just explore that with you, this idea of, you know, this kind of hypocrisy that we see in academia.
I relate to what you say, and I do agree that there is quite a lot of hypocrisy. This is, after all, a space where many, at least in social sciences and humanities, claim that they are conscious about social inequalities and injustices. But on the other hand, to think this way is to consider academia a different space than other spaces in our society. And I don't see it like that. I think academia is an extension of the larger society, and it also inherits all the existing problems in that society. It is driven by a capitalist neoliberal logic. It is extremely individualistic. Racialization happens in the academy. And I think we can think about academia as a white institutional space to get inspired by critical race theory. This means that it's a space founded on racial hierarchies and orders. So it is a space that historically claims that knowledge production happens in specific geographies. You know, here's the brain of the world, and here's the rest of the world, and so on. So all kinds of inequalities and injustices that we have in the larger environment also exists in the academy. So I don't see it as a separate space, and I think we shouldn't be shocked by things that we see in academia, or at least I'm not anymore. I think it makes more sense to see academia not as an anomaly, but as a part of the larger structural problems that we have.
I think, I mean, the point we make is, look, it's none the difference, but I completely agree with Ladan. This is something that, you know, we kind of challenged that idea with the book, saying, you know what, it carries over, everything carries over and carries on. But I am on board with you, Deepak, on this remark that yes, it does have this self-proclaimed special status, right? So academia says, oh wow, we are critical scholars. You know, we're critiquing, for example, in my field, EU external relations. You know, people would be doing critical research on how EU is run in its development politics to Africa. And then at the same breath, they will say, oh yeah, this new decentralization agenda tells me I need to collaborate with African scholars, but I haven't met any. I've been working on it for 10 years and I don't know any reliable African scholars. I'm like, you've just declared yourself professionally unfit. Like, what do you mean you've been working on EU-Africa relations for 10 years and you don't have African colleagues? Like, what were you doing for the past 10 years, right? And how can you think of yourself as a critical scholar of, you know, EU-Africa relations, right? So this, to me personally, I know, like, with my brain, I know academia is just like everything else. But with my heart, I would expect slightly better from my colleagues than from my butcher or my kid's nanny at school, or, you know, things like that.
Yeah, and you see that same level of hypocrisy when, so for instance, in projects that claim that they are, you know, decolonial or postcolonial, and there was, you know, look at the citations or references that they are using, or then, you know, the way that they do the actual research on the ground, how they engage with the communities that they work with. So that's, I think, one of the contributions of our book, to break this facade, to break that facade of this claim that we are this quote-unquote progressive space.
Practice
to first
what you
do
preach.
That.
We're not practicing what we preach.
So it's like, get your house in order before you start saying, okay, let's, you know, have equality within society, whereas within the institutions, that's clearly not the case. And that's why I feel like not only a level of disappointment about the academic field, because for me, I mean, as a bachelor student, I was thinking, okay, we're doing these courses for tackling these social issues. Mm-hmm. And then to be in the corridors of the department, realize actually, well, we're just perpetuating what are the things that we're supposedly fighting against. This, I think, not only is it disappointing, but just hypocritical for me, just to have that experience and to read the experiences that you guys have had in your book, in your chapters. So I think that for me is a real big takeaway about being disappointed and finding the academic institutions quite hypocritical.
So one of the things that struck me, and which I relate with from Olga's piece, actually, was a question that repeated itself in that chapter, and which I read as a question, Olga, you were putting to the reader too, right? This question of, do you miss home? And I started thinking about this the other day as someone who is a migrant academic, but ultimately also from the global north. I just don't find it that easy anymore to answer that question.
This is an interesting question for me. And I have some resistance toward this notion of home, especially if it is used in a romanticized or essentialized way in the migration context. Let me use myself as an example here. I have a dual Iranian-Belgian nationality. And this nationality, dual nationality, gives me all kinds of privileges. Because of my Belgian nationality, I have access to much better mobility. Borders are not as hostile to me as they are to someone with an Iranian passport, which is a very precarious passport. But besides this privilege, there is also disadvantages to my dual nationality. In the case of Iranian dual nationality, it specifically reduces or in my case, eliminates my access to my birth country because, and this is a complex issue, but in short, the Iranian state systematically arrests dual nationals and uses them as bargaining chips with European and North American countries. And I'm not alone in this. It is quite risky for someone with a dual Iranian nationality like myself, who also works on topics that are quite politicized inside Iran, to travel to the country. But I still consider Iran my country and my home. I also consider Belgium and the Netherlands, by the way, where I live currently, my home. And I don't feel 100% belonging in any of these countries, even though I speak Flemish and Dutch and have a good social life. But I think it's really important to decouple a sense of belonging from the notion of home. Many people, such as self-exiled people or refugees, may not necessarily or immediately feel perfect belonging in the countries they take refuge in. And they will miss their birth countries, but this doesn't mean that their new countries are not their homes. So, you know, they may or may not be able to create communities where they feel perfect belonging in the new countries. But I want to emphasize that a sense of belonging and the idea of home don't always perfectly overlap with each other. And not everyone has the privilege of, you know, traveling back and forth to their hometown and to see their loved ones. And this is something really difficult to explain and part of the complexity of the experience of migration.
Ah, and that's exhausting. I was just, sorry, this is just the key word I had in my mind, you know, that you're like always reflecting on everything while others don't or don't have to or don't need to. And this reflection, of course, you know, takes your brain space, your energy, your time. And I think that's what makes us, you know, stronger and more self-aware individuals than we would be without this experience, perhaps. But yeah, I mean, where is my home? I'm really glad you picked up on that in the essay. I think it was important for me to show that, you know, this relationship to home, and also the way I write it, the question is recurring because people keep asking me that question, right? But it's also my answer to it changes. And I think maybe the aspect of age is also important for my story, because I always say, you know, I'm 36, but I'm from Ukraine. That's like I'm 50 European standards, right? Because we're on a different timeline. I graduated school at 16. I did not skip any years. I turned 17 in August, and 1st of September I started university. At 21 I was fully trained trained lawyer. At that point, I already worked for 2 years in the law firm on the part-time in mergers and acquisitions. At 23, I got married. At 28, I had a kid. Like, yeah. And that was late by Ukrainian standards. Like, I have the youngest kids of all of my classmates because many of their kids are already teenagers and started university, right? So I always say, like, my life is a bit more intense, so I'm probably about to hit midlife crisis because I'm in my mid-30s. That's like mid-40s for a Western European, right? So so that's why I think also many of the answers, I just like thinking back, like, why did I experience those episodes that way? Like, I do different now, but yeah, I'm also 15 years older. You know, I was like 23 when I started my PhD. I was 27 when I finished. And most of my colleagues, because I did it in the UK, there were a lot of mature students, I think maybe more so than there would be in continental Europe when people continue into PhD from master, right? So I was like the youngest in my cohort, and people would even openly say, like, this is ridiculous. Like, people under 30 shouldn't be allowed to do PhDs. Like, you have no life knowledge. I'm like, I don't think like maturity is strictly linked to biological age, right? And varies by personal circumstances a lot. So yeah, home. And, you know, where are you? Where do you feel home? And also, I think I'm really happy to report that I feel at home in academia. It was a conscious choice for me, even though I was ridiculously young, as we just established. I love knowledge. I love creating knowledge, acquiring knowledge, spreading knowledge. I'm completely in the zone and in my elements. In that sense, I feel at home in academia. That's not to say, you know, that I feel equally at home in the various institutions I've been to. But I feel like in academia, you need to find your tribe, surround yourself with people you want to make sure you have regular contact with. And for that, you need to collaborate on things. But yeah, I mean, also, I did catch myself thinking, okay, I've been living in Brussels for almost 14 years now, and that's longer than I've lived in my hometown, where I've lived for 11 years, and which I consider, you know, my absolute home. I'm like, I've lived in Brussels longer than there. Like, does that make Brussels, like, more my home than Kamianets? And what do I do with that? I don't know if you guys...
I went back home to do my PhD, so I was back in London. For 5-6 years. So I've only just left the UK again 2 years ago. So I think my experience is quite different in that sense. I don't have that kind of, oh God, where is home? So I think for me, still home is where my family is. Like, so my parents, my brother, my niece and nephew. But yeah, for me, I don't have that issue yet. I think I'm still settling into the Netherlands. So I don't have that experience so far.
But there's this really wonderful formula I read in a novel once that home is where your actions have consequences. And to me, like, I wrote that down. I have it on post-its. And so, like, you know, home is where my actions have consequences, or, you know, where my existence is of consequence. And that's, and there can be many of those places.
Yeah. Thinking about precarity, coming back to this key theme, I think for a lot of people, home gives stability, or the certainty of home provides stability. I think one thing for the migrant academic, especially if what would be considered their home nation or their home place or wherever is suddenly not available anymore, this sense of stability leaves, right? To a certain extent. Because now you're questioning, well, where is my next home? If, let's go back to visas, what if my visa runs out and I can't get it renewed? What if financially I don't get any funding? And I can't, you know, yeah, sure, I may get my visa renewed, but now I can't afford to carry on with this project or that project.
I think being a migrant is a very diverse experience, and there's very privileged forms of migrancy as well, right? Sure. And I can say the same thing about precarity, and that's something that I want to clarify about our book, because we talk about precarity, and precarity is in the title, but precarity is not experienced in the same way. Yeah. And there is also privileged forms of precarity. So precarity is not, again, it's not a homogeneous experience. We have people who are precarious in the sense that they are in, you know, bad contracts, they have really bad relationships with their managers, or, you know, they're suffering from existing institutional problems at their own institutions. Or we have people who are experiencing precarity in the sense that they cannot provide for themselves or for the family. So there is so many different ways that precarity is experienced in the book as well.
Okay, so now thinking about you as writers, you are migrant academics compiling this book about academia in the global north. And though it's not necessarily the case, there could be pushback. I wondered how much your own precarity crept up in your minds during the process of getting these chapters together. I mean, regardless of whether levels of precarity are subjective, one's precarity can increase and decrease in intensity, right? So was there a sense when making this book of, oh, we may have increased what was already a precarious situation for ourselves here with this project?
Yes, we were very aware about this, and we were also made more aware by our contributors who came to us with their concerns and worries. And I think our awareness grew through the interactions that we had with them about the issues that they were raising. But even so, I have to add that I think I was still quite naive before this project. I wasn't aware of the level of fear that some of our colleagues have of being scapegoated or marginalized in their academic communities. So this was for me an eye-opening experience. But I think I can say this on behalf of ourselves and also our contributors, that we all thought the value of the work we did was much more than that fear. Another thing that I was quite worried about was that because of the unconventional nature of the book, it would be considered a less serious academic work. And I think I even mentioned this in my chapter that I was anxious about how fellow academics will read and perceive this book. And to console myself, I actively thought about wonderful academics who write narratives and whose work I assign in my classes and that students really love. Among these are anthropologist Shahrab Khosravi, sociologist Elizabeth Ettore, and anthropologist Ruth Behar, who also writes novels beside her academic work. And looking at these academics who have been successful in reconciling narratives with great and impactful academic work was an empowering exercise for me.
On academics who write novels, there is Lea Ipi, who is professor of political theory and wrote an Albanian migrant academic in the UK who wrote a best-selling book, Free. There is one of our authors, Vyosa Muslu, who is currently finishing her novel, I Won't Tell You On What, and others. There is plenty of, you know, Elif Shafak, everybody knows, the Turkish-American writer. She's also a professor of political science, gone writer. In that sense, I think there's a lot of potential in the crossover and migration by academics from one to the other. On the pushback, like I said, we're still in the honeymoon phase. I don't think we've experienced pushback. Also thinking back, when we started this book, we were more precarious than we are now. So I think we were more maybe aware and worried of pushback then, and we took this decision to like, okay, that's it, we take the risk then. So it's not something that's been keeping me awake at night. Now like, oh my God, the book's coming out, how will they read it? But fair enough, we don't write about our current employer. It's only stories of the past, of the previous previous experiences, previous settings. In the sense what you were saying, will this be taken serious enough? I mean, for me, this is completely overstepping, right? So I'm in an entirely different field. I work on international relations, European international relations, area studies. I don't work on migration studies, gender studies, or, you know, academic mobility studies. So my colleagues, when I would tell this to my immediate colleagues, you know, they would rather respond with curiosity, like, oh, what's that? Like, what are you doing? What's that method again? Did you need to buy software to process that kind of stuff? Like, you know, because they work with large teams and projects, they buy data. I'm like, I don't have data to buy. Like, it's human stories. It's like, so it's rather like, will this even be seen as part of my work or as an extracurricular activity? So in my mind, I'm like, this is an extracurricular activity. I'm doing this anyway, because I find this extremely important. And just to give you an insight, when I was starting this, I was on the last year of my postdoc with no job in sight, and I was thinking, this is it, academia is done for me. This is my last year. What do I want to do? I definitely don't want to finish my postdoc, so I'm dropping that, and I'm going to put myself into the migrant academics book. And that's the point where I'm at. You know, Eladen and I met and actually got real, right? So I was like, this is my swan song, the last thing I want to be remembered by when I'm finished in academia, right? Which we laugh at now, but that was very much I mean, now, like 3 years later, when I'm a tenured professor, assistant professor. In that time, I think that was it. And also maybe I would encourage people to scrap that. I just want to share a story that actually, when I was applying for this job, I had to, as part of application file, I had to submit 2 samples of writing, and I was like, what do I submit? I just went to va-bank, right? Is that the word in English?
I have no idea.
It's like when you are playing poker and you put all your chips.
We have a poker face.
Yes. Yeah. So like when you go all in, you put all your money in the next round. Yeah. And I submitted 1 article, which was a single-authored impact factor journal, academic publication on my field of expertise. Yeah. And then I submitted my autoethnographic essay on my position in academia. And wow. I wrote a cover letter and I said, these are 2 pieces, these are 2 sides of me, these are 2 research areas. This is me rocking it in the conventional, what you want from me. This is me doing something critical and what I really appreciate. And I thought, like, that's the best way to present me. That's maybe what's unique of me compared to others. Yeah. And also, at some level, you know, if they can't appreciate that, I don't want to be there. You know, maybe that's not the place for me to be, because I don't want to swim against the stream the whole time. Yeah. As a migrant academic, you're always swimming a little bit against the stream. And I'm like, you know, at some point it's going to stop because it's tiring.
But maybe having said all this, we also have to add that so far, and not only that we haven't received any, you know, pushback, we have received extremely positive feedback on this volume. We are both, I mean, this is very important for us because this project has been super personal for both of us. And we are really blessed with fantastic comments. And we received personal notes saying things like, and on social media as well, by the way, not only by email and through, you know, conventional channels, but people saying, thank you for doing this. Also, I want to be on board. Can I do something, in the next volume where you publish? And also saying, please write the way that you do. Yep. So really people recognizing the value of this way of writing rather than, you know, what we were talking about, the conventional mainstream academic writing.
So that was the episode with Olga Ladan. Worth mentioning, we actually had Ladan on previously. So she did one of the OWL episodes regarding Iran and the protests that were taking place in the second, the first half of 2023. And so, this was kind of how we got interested in this topic, was talking to Ladan, seeing what she's doing recently. And she mentioned that she's releasing this book with Olga. And also, I think you knew Olga, right? Carl,
I didn't know Olga. I read an article.
That's it.
Autoethnographical article from her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Before we spoke to Ladan.
Yes. Right? And then that's how we talked about it, right? And we were like, cool.
Yeah, exactly. Because after our interview with Ladan for the OWL episode, I remember discussing like, oh yeah, because you know there was this article from Olga. I think it's one of your colleagues. She says, oh yeah, we're working on a book. Mm-hmm. What? Yeah. So it was an extremely interesting conversation.
Yeah.
And also really interesting book. I think it's important to say that we went for lunch right after this interview, right?
Yeah.
And we just started recounting our own narratives for a good hour or so.
Yeah.
So it's an inspiration, quite frankly, and also an invitation to reflect, especially if you relate to the stories or the narratives or even just one of the stories within this book.
Yeah,
to reflect on your own experiences from an autoethnographical perspective. So,
for me, it's left an impression more so than not to say the other episodes we've done haven't left an impression and aren't some things that I think about and engage with and discuss with other people. This one really left an impression on me for a multitude of reasons. So firstly, the insight into academia that I think people don't get. So there's this constant idea of academia being, or academic circles being, this progressive institution of high standards, of meeting these high ideals, and you know, making sure that society is more equal, more equitable, more fair. And then we see these issues and these problems actually permeate within academia. I think it's a really good insight into seeing some of the hypocrisies that are often mentioned or cited in kind of academic circles and academic institutions. So on that basis, I think it's just a great insight in terms of challenging the work standards and the standards within the global north in academic circles and academic institutions. But then also, how we can do academic research differently. I also think there's a room for academia to be more creative with how we engage with ideas with knowledge and to take a little bit more of a unique and novel approach, to be perhaps more authentic in our writing style, not to just adopt a very neutral, objective approach, but actually to be quite subjective, to be quite passionate, to be quite sentimental about our research. I think is such an incredible and interesting thing that we can do. So I really like the book for actually having a different view and perspective on how academic research can be done. It's definitely had an impact on the kind of research I've been doing recently, where I have been attempting to be a little bit more authentic in the approach and try to be something like, is this something I would want to read as a non-academic or as a student that's doing this first, second year of law or politics or whatever? Would I be engaging with this? Would this be something that I relate to and I feel relevant? So I think it's had a huge impact on me on that basis.
Yeah, I think the invitation I took from reading this book is maybe to phrase what you're saying a little bit differently. The invitation I got was to be honest when writing, right? In the sense that, okay, one's always honest when writing, I hope. But to be honest about the subjectivity of your writing. So even if you do think, hey, I'm going to try and take this objective approach, yes, but even that choice itself is a choice that is being made, and how you implement your own methods, the way you engage with your research, the specific sources you choose, and you do not choose, you know, to think about all of that within your own biographical setting, cultural setting, contextual place in time and space is definitely a valuable one. Hard to do, by the way, like, God, it's very hard. I don't know if you've tried. I tried to maybe write in the style of these chapters, the beginning of one of my pieces recently. And I was just like, oh, to really force myself to not get into the standard trappings of how I normally write.
That's interesting, because I've actually had the opposite effect, where I've actually found it easier and more enjoyable to write in that fashion, in that sense. So like, yeah, just being, okay, this is what I want to talk about, and I want to kind of present these ideas in this kind of more authentic fashion, maybe because I'm trying to be, as you said, more honest. I find it actually easier. Maybe the techniques that I've learned through my PhD have clearly not entrenched deep enough that I'm able to just pull them out straight away.
Maybe it's me being, let's say, not courageous enough to, you know, unbind myself from the shackles of safety, mm-hmm, of what I've learned, right? Maybe I'm so safe and feel so secure in doing what I know. Yeah, but I'm finding it very hard to break free, because God, what? But then what? Right?
Yeah, no, but I there's a reason for that. I mean, for a more kind of practical sense, it's harder to publish.
Right? Because, well, maybe I don't know.
I'm assuming
downloads.
Yeah, exactly.
Better not be.
But I mean, that's a book, right? So you've got a bit more leeway with that. But let's say you're writing a paper. I think you've not perhaps got the same freedom to just be like, oh yeah, I'm going to write in a very different style.
I wouldn't
be surprised when people would be like, well,
I mean, at least it depends on the journal, right?
Yeah, exactly. Journals be like, ah, well, I don't like this writing style. Need to rework that. I can definitely see that being a case.
Yeah, no,
or problem.
Yeah,
so, and again, you're right. It depends on the journal for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I think it's really interesting to see that academic research can be done differently. I would say I implore other academics to try that. I'm not saying do it all the time and do it every time, but give it a go, see what you get. You might find that you're able to say something more honest, that resonates a bit stronger in terms of your work. So yeah, I really like what they did in that sense. But the other thing, I suppose, the societal impact of this kind of book. So looking at some of the levels of and forms of discrimination and prejudice we see within academia, and I think that's really important, especially in a age where whenever we start talking about these things, the usual pushback is this idea of, well, you know cancel culture, woke ideas. I think it's actually really important to actually be like, well, this is a personal experience of someone. So it's not like this kind of, oh yeah, we're trying to force more inclusivity within society, within certain institutions. There's a reason for that, because if you are the one migrant academic or the one migrant worker, you do feel levels, or you do experience levels of discrimination, be it based on where you're from, your gender, your race. Like these things do make an impact, and the more information out there, the more we're able to talk about these things and discuss these things. So I think it's really important that these kind of books come out.
Yeah, and I think if you are, put it this way, for those who will find that they relate to some of the stories within this book,
yeah,
it's also a beautiful cathartic experience.
Okay, yeah, exactly.
Right, so where you go, ah, yes, I felt that too. And this person felt it in a similar way. It may not be the same way, but maybe, oh yeah, they were also angry here.
Yeah.
Well, they also felt wrongly done and maybe didn't have the courage, or
yeah,
maybe did have the courage, or maybe questioned what would happen if they had the courage to do X, Y, or Z. Mm-hmm. Such a cathartic experience, I think, but also an opportunity for to experience the stories of others, right?
Yeah.
Which you may not have been able to consider. I think you were mentioning during the interview, like it may be potentially more important for those who aren't migrant academics in the global north to read the book.
Right? Yeah, I actually think it's more important that non-migrant academics read this book, because they're like, oh yeah, probably should be a bit more aware that it's quite hard to fit into a new culture, quite hard to fit into a new institution where I don't know that many people, where perhaps it's more male dominated, or vice versa, whatever. Like, I think those things are really important for non-migrant academics, or the stereotypical academic you might find in the global north, to read this and be like, let's be a bit more empathetic towards those that are trying to fit in, trying to find their own, trying to find a new home, trying to find a new place to settle and to do work. So, and like I say, this is something not necessarily just specific for academia. This is something that people will experience in the professional environment. So it's not like, oh yeah, this is just academic specific. People who are working in, let's say, law firms, working in corporations, may experience this. So that's another reason why this isn't just necessarily a book just for academics. This is a book for everyone that has felt some form of discrimination, or that is in an environment where there is a bit of diversity, be it based on race or gender.
Absolutely. So thank you, Olga and Ladan, for compiling this book.
Mm-hmm. And I'm looking forward to the second volume. I think they are thinking about writing a second volume. So
absolutely,
do keep your eyes or ears or every sense open for that. So yeah, that was a really good episode. I really, really enjoyed that episode. I'm excited to hear how people respond to the discussions that we had.
Right, Deepak, what's our next episode? What do you want to talk about?
You'll have to wait and see. No, we've got some plans.
This is it. This is my new move to you. This is how we commit. This is how we commit to the next episode. What are we talking about the next episode?
No, we shouldn't do that. We shouldn't do that. We're not doing that. I want my get out of jail card. So we're just going to keep it quiet. We'll be back next month. Don't worry. We've got some ideas. And we'll be paving our way forward for sure.
As always, thank you for joining us on the House of Wisdom podcast. We look forward to having you join us for the next episode.